in the course is that one of the important things that kind of happens behind the scenes of all of this is something called printing. You know, this business. And it makes quite a difference. It makes quite a difference to this world of scholarship and learning to have printing. In fact, that's something we can begin to start talking about that tonight, probably. But just begin to think for a minute, what is it like when any text you're studying, if you've got one, you have either bought from a copyist who has copied it from the results of other copyists, or you do like theology classes used to do. You spend the first third of the class taking by dictation the texts you're supposed to study, and you skip four or five lines, because for the next third of the class you're going to interlineate various commentaries on these texts, which are going to be dictated to you. And then when that's all done, all these texts are intact and everybody has fairly reliably the same text because it's been dictated to them, then you talk about it. Then you hear the theology professor's views about all these things. So we could, you know, we could dictate some books until the early part of July. Right? The other problem, of course, is, and this will become quite relevant when we start looking at criticisms of the Aristotelian tradition. Galileo and his friends are quite wont to make the remark that the Aristotelians always have their nose in a book, and they seem to place great authority in texts. So whenever a question comes up, they're citing texts. Ipse dixit, the philosopher said, so and so and so and so. But when you stop to think that you're, until early in the 16th century, you're dealing with a tradition of learning at the very core of which is the problem of, do I have a reliable text? In other words, here I am studying and criticizing Aristotle, but there's a fairly important question of whether what I've got in front of me is really Aristotle, or some screwed up version of it. Part of that problem provides the impetus, of course, for what people later call humanism. Because everyone knows in the 12th and 13th century that Thomas Aquinas knows the Aristotle he's got has come by way of Syriac and Greek and Arabic and finally into Latin. William of Morbeka, Flemish translator, is the guy who provides all kinds of Aristotle for Thomas. But it's largely coming out of, well, I think there it's coming out of Greek. But all the Aristotle before that is Arabic to Latin translations, done very often by a trilingual of Jews in Spain who read Arabic, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Trilingual, what do I mean? Many multilingual. Gerard of Cremona is one of them. Anyway, now how did we get onto that? Reading.
Where did the humanism come from?
Well, finish the thought, eh? Copernicus is the second generation of professional astronomers. He's in the second generation of professional astronomers who can put in front of them the original Greek Ptolemy. Johannes of Königsberg, who changes his name to Regio Mountainus, he's from the King's Mountain, so he makes it Latin, Königsberg. He has in his hands the original Greek Ptolemy brought to Italy from Constantinople by Greek refugees. And this is the first time in the Latin West that people have the real Ptolemy. What everybody's been dealing with since then is there, the tradition as it has arrived as of 1372, say, in the south of France. And it's a tradition that's been through Greek and then through several centuries of Arabic astronomers. So if you're going to criticize Ptolemy, you are never quite sure until you get the original whether you're dealing with subsequent modifications, revisions. And in fact, the very top people know that there are many versions of Ptolemy around. And the very serious students of it know something about who made what revisions, when, and in what ways. But what Regiomontanus wants to do in dealing with what he thinks is now a fairly corrupt and confused tradition is get the original text. Let's go back to the source, get the original text, get the thing that started this whole tradition going, and take a look at it. Then we can see what we want to do about this or that kind of revision or alteration or whatever. And Copernicus is in the next generation of people who is able to deal is able to deal in a fairly comprehensive way with the Ptolemaic tradition. He knows the original text and all its variants. So what humanism is all about in some in many ways is getting the original text. And this coincides, probably not accidentally, with printing, so that you have late in the 15th and early in the 16th century, in the 1510s and 20s, a press like Aldus Manutius' press in Venice, publishing definitive editions of Euclid in Greek and Latin, of Aristotle in Greek and Latin. An established printed text, which anybody who buys will have the same one as the other people who buy it. And having done that, what they discover is that classical Greek and Latin is a much neater language than the medieval Latin of the schools. I don't know if any of you, some of you may have discovered this for yourself, but if you pick up a medieval Latin text and just compare it with something from Latin 100, even Caesar and the Gallic War, medieval Latin strangely doesn't take advantage of the inflection the way classical Latin does. Medieval Latin pretty nearly has a word order. And it's almost like English in the sense that it deals with word order, and it's partly the order of the words that in our language that tells you which is a subject and which is an object and then there's the verb and so forth. Latin itself is a very highly inflected language, so by the suffixes you can tell whether it's subject, object, it's in a prepositional clause or whatnot. And what classical Latin does, and what gets some of the Renaissance scholars so excited, they take Cicero in his orations and people like that, they take advantage of the inflection to use the word order rhetorically so that in written Latin, word order becomes something like inflection of voice is in spoken English. That is, you can convey emphases, subtle emphases by conventions of word order that are rather like in a spoken language, like ours anyway, inflection can do. So it's very elegant stuff. And after the comparatively pretty dull medieval scholastic Thomas Aquinas type Latin, it's pretty exciting. So what these people simultaneously think they've discovered is a superior language and a superior bunch of people. And so the classic texts begin to acquire the kind of importance they, to some extent, still retain. So, short papers. Short, right? What I say? 2-3 pages?
Yeah, double space.
I'm imagining 250 words a page, so we're talking 1,000 words or under. And many of those questions I'm asking you to think about are right on, are very simply explication of text. Aristotle writes that.
You have put references in the end.
Oh, no. If you need to refer to something, refer to it in a way that's most clear and obvious. If it's an Aristotle handout, then you can just put parentheses page 6, or something like that. Just refer in the way that would be most obvious and appropriate. If you want to practice standard citations, I mean, go ahead. It's good to practice those things. Sometimes you have to use them. But many of these are simply explication. When Aristotle says that creature who is sufficient without the polis must either be a beast or a god, what does this mean? Well, you make use of the text and your own reading to say what it means, what Aristotle means. Later, if you want or if you have time or if it helps, you can feel free to say what you think of this, but the question isn't asking what you think of it. It may well be that nobody cares what you think of it, but a lot of people care what Aristotle thought or not. So a lot of those questions are like that. So fairly just straightforward prose. Does anybody else have any questions ready to speak? Yeah.
So do you want us to answer all of those questions?
No. Pick one. Or make up your own out of... No, just one. Sometimes it helps to identify the question. Do indicate what question you're answering. Because sometimes I'm put in the position of the funny puzzle of what question is this supposed to be an answer to?
Makes it easier to write, I'm sure.
It makes it easier to understand what I think you're doing. What do I think? See, I have the job of interpreting. What question does so-and-so think he is answering? To what possible question could this be an answer? Steve Allen used to have a great routine like that on TV in the 50s, back in the Age of Reason. That comes after the Renaissance. He had a thing called The Answer Man. No, there was a legitimate radio thing called The Answer Man. He had a crazy character called The Question Man. People mailed in answers. he would tell them what questions was the answer to. The one that I remember the best is this one. One of the people on his show was a
tree surgeon.
How many doctors are there in Brooklyn?
Tree surgeons.
All right. Anyway, so these papers are due the next time we meet, is that right? Okay. And there's a bunch of stuff for you to read, so you don't get bored. And so on. All right, so let's carry on with where we were. Where we were was, we were ready to move over into trying to get a sense, talking about what is Aristotle's account of human beings. We laid out this whole story about naturally existing things and set out this proposal that naturally existing things are what they are because each one of them is an individual material realization of the very whatness of the thing, and that each of these essences or whatnesses or however you want to call it is a species, is a kind of thing, a natural kind. And exists eternally as an idea. Which is continually being embodied in many individual instances of it. Okay? Now, this is why, I mean, since this is the kind of thing Aristotle has been playing, this is why I mentioned way back when we started that really a key to understanding what this natural philosophy could be about and how it could seem plausible is to get used to the idea of what it looks like, what it feels like, actually to believe that immaterial things exist. Remember, and so we talked about triangles, and I tried to persuade you that your discourse about triangles seemed not only to presuppose, but in some sense to reveal that you talked about these objects as if they were perfectly real, and yet these objects seemed to me, at least in terms of how people talk about them, would have to be immaterial things which you could only know in your mind, or with your mind, and that you could refer to corporeal, sensible, material versions of them, triangles, cubes, so on, but that the real thing itself, the genuine thing, is an immaterial thing and something grasped only by mind and not an object of sense, perception at all. Well, roughly, that's the kind of thing that Aristotle thinks is true about all naturally existing things. Not only is it true of artificial things, perhaps, like triangles or chairs. Remember we talked about the idea of a chair that in some sense precedes the chair. Now in just this sense, the idea of a cat or a duck or a fir tree or any other species, any other natural kind of thing, the idea in some sense precedes the individual thing, is prior to. And for these naturally existing things, the whatness, or the essence, is what Aristotle wants to call their psyche, their soul. It is what animates them. So in the case of our little, let's put a kitten on the table here, here's a little cat. Kitten, this thing has a soul in some sense. It is the catness of it that is its soul. This thing is probably most properly and directly described as the very idea of a cat, or as Aristotle says, it's probably a fairly cumbersome translation, the first grade of actuality of the thing. But it's the very idea of a cat that is its soul. And this thing, which exists, does have the power, it appears, to organize all this material, I guess basically Purina, cat, chow, and milk. It organizes all this material into cat, into a particular individual cat.
The soul has the power?
The soul is the agent. The soul is the efficient cause of this thing becoming more cat-like.
But is it a real cat?
It is a perfectly real individual material embodiment of the very idea of Katniss. And it's perfectly real. Absolutely. There's nothing shadowy about it. It isn't the same thing as the Katniss of a cat. This happens to be an individual material embodiment of that idea. And
Katniss of the cat is the soul.
That's right. That's right.
And the body is almost the imitation.
Well, the body is it's just like the chair. That all the Purina cat chow and milk and whatnot are being, and mice, are being organized into cat, just the way you or I could organize a bunch of bits of tree. Pardon me?
They're one. In the form, you're going to have the cat.
Well, that's a way of looking at it.
So in effect, do we have anything that is actually what it appears to be?
We'd have a lot that is actually like it appears to be.
We're the embodiment, I guess, of the humanness.
That's right.
But we aren't human in court, I guess. I'm not exactly sure how to understand.
That's what we're working on.
So is there anything that is actually the thing that is embodied? That blackboard is an embodiment of our idea of a blackboard. Is it a blackboard?
Yeah.
Is the soul material?
Well, Aristotle discusses this a bit, even in the stuff I've handed you, right? And he says a number of things. Some of them don't go down too well with later Muslim, Jewish, or Christian Aristotelians, so they have to change them a bit. They don't regard it as essential. The discussions I remember clearly are all of them kind of analogy things. Aristotle seems to have, as I think I do, a fairly clear idea of what is meant here, but finds it hard to say more about it than just what's said. But there's one place where someone asks the obvious kind of question, I guess, about, well, I'd like to know more about this business of soul. What is it? Some people think the soul lives on somehow, exists after. And Aristotle says, well, no, none of that. The soul really is the form. And in one sense, the soul of the cat is to the cat rather like an imprint in a piece of clay or wax is to the clay or wax, or the shape of a glass is to the glass. And if I smash the glass and then say, what happened to the shape of the glass? You know, where did it go? This is a kind of funny question. Remember, as an immaterial thing, thinking about it all by itself, it isn't locatable. Doesn't exist in space.
So it is immaterial.
Oh, sure. Yeah. The form of a cat, the very idea of a cat. I mean, look, later people like Aquinas, like Thomas Aquinas, who are very convinced about a creator God, translate all of this into ideas in the mind of God, and in some sense the blueprints of creation. So it can't be completely illegitimate, at least as analogy, to think the soul of a cat is the form of a cat, which in some sense is the blueprints you would need if you had to build a cat.
Okay, but the soul is also, you said, the efficient cause.
Yes.
So it animates.
That's right. Well,
growth.
That's not a bad word, is it? Because what's the Latin word for this? Parapsyche in Latin is de anima, on the soul.
And also, of course, if you're talking about blueprints, if you have a blueprint of a cat, you assembled all the proteins, all this, that, the other, it's like that, we've got to make it a cat. But I mean, you know, we can't build
Right. But you see, the idea, I think what he's suggesting is probably on the right track. You could have this blueprint of CAP, that is the complete physiology, microanatomy, or whatever it's called, and somehow or other, with lots of money, assemble, molecule by molecule, a cat. I think Aristotle's view would be you have built a very good reproduction of a cat, but the thing's not alive. It just sits there like a chair. This is an artificial cat. Now, it may be a scale, a one-to-one model of a cat, but it's a model of a cat. It's not a living cat. It's not growing. The real cat makes itself. You see? The real cat is busy. The real cat has a project all its own called becoming more of a cat. Well, they're not so inanimate. I mean, consider my heavy thing, right? This is nearly inanimate because it's very dumb, right? But it's growing. And you can see it grow. It's growing more, it's growing heavier. It is essentially a heavy thing. It is actualizing its heaviness, just like that kitten actualizes its catness, just like that tree is actualizing its specieshood, whatever it is. Well, the floor is in the way. Well, take some floor away. It's doing the best it can.
So it's still
Yeah.
So then the chair is also animate.
The material of the chair as heavy stuff, the chair does that too. But that's not the chairness of it. That's chair qua heavy thing. I mean, I do that too. If I go out the window, boom, like I'm no different. Eraser, right? Because I'm made out of stuff, just like you, the cat too. A dead cat and a live cat will fall pretty much the same way.
The living is the fact that it's growing, the fact that it's actualizing itself.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that's the thing that makes it living. It's doing that because it's living.
Okay, so then you're trying to tell me that the chakra is also living?
In that sense. It's animated. Look, it is self-growing. It's moving itself. We could back up and say, okay, there's cats, there's trees, there's fish, there's all these things that look like it would be proper and sensible to say about them. They are actualizing a capacity to be something. Okay? Here's this little, bald, funny-looking thing, and turns out it's a baby mouse. So it's busy becoming a mouse. That's what it does with its life. It fulfills its mousehood. All by itself. Right? Okay, we could say, all right, that sounds like a reasonable story, or at least a plausible story about living things, and they even reproduce themselves. And that's part of the story. Now, what about this? Right? I mean, you could say this is a little problem off in the corner somewhere. What about these? What about that? Well, I mean, suppose your attention were fixed on what we call biology. Here's the world of zillions of reproducing, living, growing things. What are they doing? What's going on here? And we tell this story about about something that is animating this growth, where more and more material is being organized into cat. But if the mouse eats the same, this mouse nibbles on the same bag of cat chow, the mouse turns into more of a mouse. If you put the mouse in a desert, like in the middle of a big Safeway parking lot, you know, it's curtains for the mouse. Now, mice usually do better than that, but if you don't give this mouse material to keep organizing in the mouse, it's finished. I mean, its project is, it can't carry on its project. It has these requisites. Now, wait a second. So here's all these living things engaging in their projects. If that's where your mind was at with all these species and you said that's the kind of overwhelming thing that's going on, then you'd be inclined to say, I think, I'm not saying this is a forceful argument, I'm just trying to make it plausible, you'd be inclined to say, well, this must be that kind of thing too. And here's something that's plainly, how do you know what, I mean, here's an, you want to be an operationist or something? All right, let's, we'll define an operation whereby we identify, we say, we know the way to find out what the essence of a thing is what does the thing do when you leave it alone? Now, I grant you there's a little fudge built into, well, how do you know when it's left alone? But let's just take standard, when you leave it alone, what does it do? Well, mice left alone get more and more mousy. Cats don't leave mice alone, right? But cats have a project in which they turn mice into cats, right? They take in mice and become more cats. So, I mean, there are these colliding projects a lot. In fact, that's, in one sense, Aristotle's probably the most succinct definition of what's an accident. An accident is the collision of projects. The mouse got, you know, if I get hit by a bus, this is a collision of projects. There's 14 people on their way out to UBC, and I'm on my way somewhere else, and these two projects collide, and that's it. It's an accident.
So the cat catching the mouse is not ever part of the cat's essence.
No, but the cat's going to gobble up the mouse and turn it into a cat.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah.
So that's just an accident that the cat happens to chase mice because they run into.
Well, from the point of view of the mouse, it's an accident.
Okay.
Yeah. This is not part of its mousehood to become fuel for cathood. I mean, that particular mouse, that particular cat. That things are going to take in material and turn it in, grow. I always call it growing. See, what Aristotle, perhaps you figured this out from your reading, what Aristotle means by the word that gets translated into Latin and English and other modern languages as motion is, well, in some people want to say the best way to render it really is change, but well, maybe change, and then there's natural change and not natural or violent change. But so in the reading you have, you see this distinction between natural and non-natural or violent motion. But I think, although nobody seems to have worked this in, and maybe there's something wrong with it, I think probably the best way to think of motion is as growth. Although that would best be natural motion. Natural motion is growth. Violent motion is some kind of unnatural change, non-natural change wrought upon something from the outside. So natural things are self-growing, self-moving things. So with all of that in mind, when I come across something like this, I say, all right, what does it do when it's left alone? Well, right now I'm not leaving it alone. Now I'm leaving it alone. Now the floor is not leaving it alone. We can just see, we take away the floor, it'll just hear. That's what it does when it's left alone. So, I say, huh, there must be something about that thing. It is expressing itself when I leave it alone. It's expressing the essence of what it is. When I leave it alone, when I give it a chance. And so now I know something more about this thing. I know what this thing is essentially. as a heavy thing. I mean, I never, I realize it's an eraser. That's what it is. It's what we built here. But it's made out of stuff, and the stuff, left to itself, simply wants to get more perfectly what it is, heavy stuff. So we make up a story that's akin to the story about the cat, that this thing is embodying heaviness, and that what it is doing as it is simply changing position. I mean, that's really dull. Just imagine how dull it would be if, as you changed position in one direction, you became a better human being. You know, the closer you get to Burnaby or something. You become, right? So you just, this is called becoming a better human being. Right? And that's all that's doing. It's just getting closer to a place where it is completely fulfilled. So it's pretty limited character. Right? There's not much for it to do. That's all it does. So you make that story up about it. And notice what spins out of that is spherical resting earth, made out of a great spherical glob of all this dirt.
Even cat stuff does that.
The cat's organizing itself. The cat is a material embodiment of catness. This is material.
Yeah.
For all I know, a cat can find some nutrition in chewing on this thing. Some things could. Goats. This is fruit. Right?
Goat.
And a tree is a material embodiment of what it is. But they're all taking in, I mean, at the end of the day, all of these things are made out of a particularly and uniquely structured arrangement of earth, air, fire, and water. That's all the stuff there is.
Did Aristotle worry about reproduction at all?
Oh, yeah.
Defining
me? Absolutely.
Thrush doesn't reproduce.
Right. Well, see, this is just material.
Okay, if we consider it just material.
From the point of view of the natural world, this is just bits of dead tree and stuff dug out of the ground. And were it not for what we're interested in, this, you know, it's just junk. It's just stuff. This too, just stuff. I mean, there's another bit of dead tree, and what this is.
Wouldn't Aristotle have to say that the chair is the project?
Absolutely not, because this doesn't grow in the woods. Right?
It would seem to me that Hesper would have trouble with artifacts that humans make.
I don't.
Fashion out of something else. Because if for there to be a chair, there must be the essence of a chair somewhere.
There has to be the idea of a chair somewhere.
That's
right. It's not a naturally existing thing, except in a derivative sense. I mean, what about a spider web? That's an artifact, too, or a bird's nest. The idea of a chair must exist, but chairness is not a species. It's not a natural kind of thing.
But it does make a distinction between
artifact and
artifact.
That's right.
Where is the idea? I mean, let us extrapolate back to before there was human.
There was never such a time.
Never.
Never.
So we always had these ideas, so everything had
somebody. Oh, no. Not necessarily. The idea of a cat is not an idea we have. We know what a cat is when we, how should I put it? Are moved by the idea of cat so that we comprehend what a cat is.
Where did this idea come from?
It didn't come from anywhere because it never wasn't. You mean the idea of a chair? Or the idea of a cat?
Well, let's say
Okay. It's an eternally existing immaterial thing. It never came from anywhere. It always has been. It didn't ever begin. There was never a time when there wasn't the very idea of a cat.
Aren't all ideas implicit in God?
Well, there's obviously lots of different ways of putting that. Where we ended up last time was, and most of this is just me saying, in other words, what I think Collingwood's explication says. These ideas, I mean, here's the theory. It's a hypothesis. It's a story that's been made up to account for things. These ideas exist, and they exist, in a sense, prior to any of the things. Does that mean that once upon a time there was just the idea and no thing? No, that's not what it means. It's not chronologically prior. It's, in a sense, logically prior. You can't have a chair until, you can't have a chair except as the realization of the idea of a chair. Now, it might be dialectical, which I think both Plato and Aristotle believe about artifacts. The first idea you might have had is something as dim as it would be nice to sit down, you know, or it would be nice to get something hard with a back. And I mean, it's very vague. So you go and get bits of dead, you go and get bits of hard stuff.
And you start, can't create new ideas, can you?
I don't know why, in terms of artifacts, you can't have new ideas. It all depends what you mean by new.
Where would they, I mean, they would have logically had to exist prior to the, to your mind being informed by the idea.
Well, wait a minute, we're getting confused between two different things.
For an artifact, if you want to keep the wheel, the man puts down a log on a slope, it rolls down the hill, and gets off, he gets the idea. That is something that
gets the
wheel.
Yeah.
You know, until he thought, I can use that to transport something as a wheel. It was just a log rolling down the hill. When he starts thinking of it in terms of using it as transport, it becomes the wheel.
All right.
Yeah, so the idea of the wheel has to be there before it's anything other than just a log rolling down the hill.
Or around them.
Around them.
I don't think ideas like that have to always be.
You would never get a new artifact, or all new artifacts become a new old artifact.
Well, that it might be right in one sense that whatever you're thinking about is some combination of already known of that thing. So a chair is just another version of something to sit on.
The Greeks knew the new
invention. Oh, sure.
They invented the flesh pillow.
How about saran wrap?
Yeah, well, that's right. Some things are so novel that, I mean,
maybe not. But I guess I don't see the problem about artifacts.
So artifacts, the ideas of which they are the material embodiment, don't exist eternally.
No, of course not. Okay. Absolutely, of course not.
So there's two different types of ideas.
Well, just if you think there are two different kinds of things, naturally existing things and artifacts.
Well,
naturally existing things are things that exist by nature. They are there all by themselves. They don't need to be brought into being by some other creature. Chairs don't grow in the woods. So chairness is not a natural kind of thing. Okay? And I think the business of getting the idea of the chair isn't a problem. I mean, it's like the wheel.
Are you saying that artifacts?
Yeah, I was trying very hard to say something like that. Yeah, okay. Now, I've kind of lost track of where we were going.
Is it not often explained that the chair or the thing and the idea of the thing inform one another?
No, don't think so. The business of informing, I mean, that's another way of talking about what's happening with a cat. or the chair, but remember, this is something we make. It's not, nature doesn't make it. One way of talking about the cat is to say that the cat is a bunch of stuff informed by catness. That's the form. It is in form. It is an embodiment of a form. So you could say informed. Sure. This is a process of informing. And quite literally, that sounds right. Okay, look, let's carry on.
Yeah, human
Aristotle. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Okay. So now what about human beings? Okay. Well,
couldn't Aristotle include the idea that there was some creator who which everything that is made is an artifact of the creator?
Well, except that's right. I was dealing with. So here are all these ideas. Now, it seems to me what Aristotle is saying, and other Aristotelians will say different things about this, depending on their, if you want, theology. Aristotle, I think, is saying, look, the account I'm giving of the nature of things seems to arrive at the conclusion